From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Lafayette, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support, for every one of you, and for the contributions you make to our show. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Thursday is the Sikh observance of Baisakhi, and on Friday, Hindus mark Ramana Vami. In Rome, Pope Francis released the much-anticipated apostolic exhortation titled The Joy of Love. The document, a culmination of a two-part global synod process, is still being scrutinized by both conservative and liberal Catholics for what it means about divorced people and LGBT members of the church and what's going to happen to them. But the Pope's not going to sit around reading Twitter reactions to the document. I guarantee you that. Next Thursday, he's scheduled to visit refugees on the Greek island of Lesbos. Now, to the campaign trail. Ted and Bernie won Wisconsin. The punditocracy declared that now everything has changed. But it's what they say every week, hoping you'll stay glued to the never-ending breaking news cycle that's the media equivalent of puffed rice snacks. You feel like you've eaten something, but it's really mostly hot air. In a bid to foster maximum divisiveness among the Mississippians and provoke the fury of scores of businesses, the state eagerly joined North Carolina as a target for national outrage this week when Governor Phil Bryan signed a blatantly anti-gay, quote, religious freedom bill into law. And Tennessee moved closer to declaring the Bible the official state book. Now, to keep things in perspective, Tennessee already has an official state rifle, two official state rocks, four official state bugs, and an official state fruit, the tomato. Now, here's what's coming up on State of Belief Radio. This week, the American Civil Liberties Union of Louisiana convened two panel discussions titled Freedom for All Faiths. I was privileged to moderate one of those panels and then to participate as a panelist on the other. We gathered in New Orleans on Wednesday and in Lafayette on Thursday, and I took advantage of having like-minded activists and academics together in one place to put together this week's show. And so in the hour ahead, you'll hear Barry Lynn, who's worked diligently on issues of church-state separation for decades. I'm also delighted to have Pearson Cross, a leading commentator on Louisiana and national politics, as well as being a faculty member at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. And I'm looking forward to catching up with Zach Copland, a young secular education advocate who was born and raised in Louisiana. Our thanks to the very nice folks here at KRVS Radio on the University of Louisiana Lafayette campus for making us feel at home while away from home. The Reverend Barry Lynn is a passionate activist, an effective leader, and a prolific author. A natural fit for the Freedom for All Faiths panel, he was kind enough to accept our invitation to return to State of Belief Radio this week. I'm really glad. Barry, welcome.
It's nice to be back.
Would you start by talking a little bit about why it is important for us to be a part of these Freedom for All Faiths events?
I think it's terribly important because one of the things that is a ground of being for this American democracy of ours is the freedom to accept any of the religions that are out there, seek to find our newest one if ever a new one arises, or reject them all. This is quintessentially where conscience comes from, where freedom of belief comes from, and ultimately where the American experience grows and develops.
These panels were sponsored by the American Civil Liberties Union of Louisiana. The ACLU has been at the forefront in challenging the worst of various state-level anti-gay laws like we've just seen pass in North Carolina and Mississippi. What are your thoughts about the recent explosion of these so-called mini RFRA bills?
Yeah, I think all of this is a tremendous reaction, a backlash to the Obergefell decision, the marriage equality decision by the United States Supreme Court back in June of 2015. There were people who called that decision the beginning of the end of Western civilization. That's Matt Staver, the former dean of Jerry Falwell's Liberty University Law School. When you feel that passionate about it, what you're trying to do now is find ways to hurt the LGBT community. And hurting them, whether it's legal or not, you want to send a signal that this state, the state of Mississippi, the state of North Carolina, couldn't care less what the United States Supreme Court thinks about anything. They're on their own timeline, which is distant past, and they're on their own understanding of the Constitution, which is they still have states' rights that trump any decision of the United States Supreme Court.
Tell our listeners what they're missing about what attacks to those people and the denial of rights to them is doing to our whole democracy.
When you go after one group, and it's not your group, but it could be your group. And although I don't like to use the slippery slope argument very often, because I think it's bad enough when you deny rights to anyone, to any group. But in this case, there's total misinformation. There is an absolute fear, a panic over the change, the modernity that the world seems to be associating itself with. And certainly this country does, with the exception of a few unnamed presidential candidates. We look like we're moving to the future.
There is also a danger here related to the Hobby Lobby decision about giving religious freedom, so-called, to corporations as well as people. Talk a little about that.
No, absolutely. Hobby Lobby is one of the worst decisions on the planet in modern constitutional history. It was bad enough when corporations were claimed to have the right of freedom of speech, but at least corporations have as one of their principal jobs to advertise. That is a kind of speech. But the idea that a for-profit company like Hobby Lobby, this national chain of arts and crafts stores, could practice religion is itself astonishing. Now things have gotten even worse. The United States Supreme Court just a few weeks ago considered the question of what, if any, options can be given to religiously affiliated universities, colleges, hospitals that have employees that would like to have contraceptive insurance as a part of the package. And the Obama administration says that, well, you don't have to pay for it directly. All you have to do is sign a statement if you're an institution like Notre Dame, where we represent a couple of students ourselves. All you have to do is sign a 737-word document that says, well, we can't in good conscience do this, put it in a post box, and send it to the federal government. But many of these colleges and universities that get gazillions of dollars in student assistance, in grants and contracts, just say, we can't do that. To declare to the government that we have a conscientious objection to something is itself a violation of our free exercise of religion. That is so preposterous that only one court in the country has accepted it, went to the United States Supreme Court. Now, as you know, we have only 8 members on the court. It looks like it was heading for a tie, and then they actually asked for some additional briefing. I suspect that we believers in contraceptives insurance for everyone will actually win the case sometime later in the year. But when I was standing outside of the court, I always have a choice. Do I go into the court and watch the argument, or do I stand outside with the people? And I chose to stand outside with the people, and I was making a little speech. And as I looked at the people on the left from some Roman Catholic schools and nuns and priests, I thought, these people don't just want to stop insurance coverage for students at religious universities, these people want to stop the availability of birth control to everyone. That's what they would be. When you have these groups, Little Sisters of the Poor, Priests for Life, if you ask them about so-called artificial contraception, they're against it, and they're against it for everybody. So that all of this is a ruse. And as you know, Welton, the people on the religious right are not satisfied just with one bite of the apple. It's kind of like a dog that comes to your house. Mm-hmm. You feed it at lunch. It doesn't bark, thank you, and go away. It comes back for the next meal, hoping you'll do the same thing. They never give up.
Barry, with what's happening at the state level, as well as the kind of presidential campaign that we've been subjected to, how worried are you really about the state of our union?
I'm very worried about it. Well, I mean, it is extraordinary to see the amount of hatred. I mean, that's really what this is, that comes across. Like, people hate the government. The government doesn't do anything for them. They hate the candidates. If they're in favor of one candidate, they hate the other candidate in both parties. This is not good for democracy. This is not good for moving us forward. Donald Trump's, statement, Make America Great Again, I think, to be honest, we've never been that great. I have a hat that has that phrase on it, and then I have a Band-Aid over the again, because I don't think we were. I mean, this is a country born in slavery. We couldn't get that right till 100 years into the country. Mm-hmm. We didn't give women the right to vote. We didn't give 18-year-olds the right to vote. These are the kinds of things that we're trying to do. We are trying to make America great. I don't even like it when politicians say, we don't have to make it great. We're great now. I don't think we are great now. We have a Supreme Court that has cut back on the rights of individuals. The Voting Rights Act has been virtually gutted by the Supreme Court when it still had 9 members. This is bad. It's bad for the country. It shows why we need activists to take a deep look at all of these issues and to make a commitment to make the Constitution work and work for everybody, and not the Constitution that certain candidates talk about, but the Constitution as it was and, most importantly, as it has grown. My friend Dean Chemerinsky, Erwin Chemerinsky, has said, of course we have a living Constitution. The alternative to it is a dead one, and who would possibly want that?
Mm. So where do we look for influences that can help bring Americans together again?
I mean, I think that there's a common decency about America that is not, unfortunately, on display much in this presidential campaign. But I think when you look at the support that people have for everything in church-state terms, don't give money to organizations that discriminate on the basis of hiring, all the way to the minimum wage. I mean, most people don't even know what the minimum wage is, but if they do, they're shocked, and they say, well, no, it should be much more than that. So the heart and soul of the American people is good. The problem is we get diverted by candidates who don't see far enough ahead, and we don't really have the vehicles these days to move people forward. Dwight Eisenhower, I think, famously said, the public's way ahead of the politicians and eventually will catch up. And he was talking about spending on defense. But I think you could say that about almost any issue today.
When you think about what we're working on now and the kinds of challenges that we're facing, is there anything you're seeing that gives you hope?
Absolutely. You know, I wrote this book, God and Government. We've talked about it before. It came out some months ago. But part of the premise of that book is that two things that I think are good. Number one, some issues we just don't litigate anymore. We don't go to court over evolution. We don't go to court over school prayer. You send a letter, you explain what the law is, and we generally get a healthy resolution. The other thing is even millennials, including evangelical millennials. These are, you know, people roughly from 20 to 30 years old. Their views on a lot of these social issues is dramatically more progressive, shall we say, than their parents or their grandparents. Even before marriage equality was the rule of the country by Supreme Court decision, close to 45% of evangelical millennials already thought that same-sex marriage was a good idea. Mm-hmm. So evolution, a tremendous increase in support for the evidence for evolution. This is what gives me a lot of hope. Of course, those millennials have to go out and vote. I like to think I was in Iowa at the time of the caucuses, and I was speaking to a couple hundred people, and the next hour, one of the Democratic candidates was there, and there's 10,000 people lined up. I'd like to think if you're willing to go and hear a candidate and stand there for 2 hours to wait for it to start, mm-hmm. you might come out and vote, because turnout was not so hot for millennials in the midterm elections. 21%. Yeah. Mm. Pathetic.
Reverend Barry Lynn is the longtime executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He's the author of the recent book, God and Government, 25 Years of Fighting for Equality, Secularism, and Freedom of Conscience. Barry, it's been great to have you in the studio today, and I thank you again, not only for what all you do for the American democracy, but also for stopping periodically and joining us on State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure. Well, always.
Dr. Pearson Cross is a university professor, a dean, and former head of the political science department, all at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. A much sought-after commentator and analyst, he's a favorite guest on this show, and I'm delighted to have this opportunity to sit down with Pearson face-to-face and have a conversation. Pearson, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Over the years, you've done a lot of writing focused on Southern politics. How are Southern politics different from politics everywhere else?
Probably the single most important thing is the conservatism that runs through it, and it's a particular religious conservatism. Southern politics is becoming less unique as a result of the South, kind of economically speaking, joining the rest of the country, and also as a result of one of the major parties now basing itself in the South fundamentally, and that, of course, would be the Republican Party. If you think about it, one of the two major parties has essentially made its home now in the South, which broadens the kind of mainstreamness of Southern politics in a way that it wasn't before.
This state, our state of Louisiana, has been profoundly affected by its years under Governor Bobby Jindal. Jindal described himself as being the most Christian candidate in the primaries, and then demonstrated actions that contradicted his confessions about Christianity, and our state literally is in a mess economically and in other ways because of that.
Bobby Jindal came in as a pragmatic technocrat with a very Ivy League kind of background. He was seen as a problem solver. His practice in government has been really very, very conservative Republican in the sense that tax cuts and diminishing the size of government has ruled all. So the piety that he's expressed in terms of Christian terms with faith and with kind of being very publicly the state's leading Christian is not really expressed in government programs, because most government programs for the poor, for people who are in need of services, for people with medical conditions, for housing, for other kinds of things have been slashed. The only thing that has really mattered ultimately to Governor Jindal has been reducing the size of the state and at the same time, in a very odd juxtaposition, increasing the amount of money that's given away to people with money. So the tax structure in Louisiana has gotten completely skewed. Louisiana has, as a result, suffered this enormous and continuing economic crisis of state government where we can't pay our bills. But at the same time, the people that are in the upper income brackets have done very well under this governor.
Mm-hmm. Is it safe to say that some of the giveaway of money was taken from public institutions like public education and invested in parochial schools to the detriment of public education?
Yeah, and that's happened in a couple of ways. You know, clearly through the voucher program, Jindal instituted a statewide voucher program, which it, had it been carried out and fully funded, would have been by far the most substantive and sweeping of any in the country. But as it is, I think there are about 7,000 children making use of these vouchers, which are mostly used at private religious schools. So you take public money from public schools, give them to kids in schools that are labeled C, D, or F, and then those students can take those vouchers and go to any school that will take them. Typically, those are underperforming religious schools. By the way, the test scores on those students are starting to come in, and they show that they're doing markedly worse than they were actually when they were in public school. Hmm. So not only does public school miss out on that money, but also the students don't seem to be that well served. He said he was a pragmatist, but actually he's an ideologue, and it's been to the detriment of the kind of common good of Louisiana, in my opinion.
What are the lasting effects of Jindal's policies?
The effects are so broad and staggering that it's going to take a generation to wash Bobby Jindal out of Louisiana's hair, frankly. Clearly, some things will never be fixed. Funding to higher education, when Bobby Jindal took office, the state was paying about 65%. Student fees and tuition were paying about 35%. Now that is flipped. Tuition and fees account for 60 to 65% of all funds to higher education. The state is only kicking in 30 to 35%. That's not the kind of thing you can change. The new governor, John Bel Edwards, has said, I want to get back to a 50-50 split. Well, of course, that would even be a big slide. In the meantime, colleges and universities have been cut by nearly $800 million. They're going to be cut again. They are cut again in this session. They're going to be cut in the next session. And this is throughout every institution. Here in Lafayette Parish, to give one example, indigent defense funds were cut over one half. The defendants waiting for representation, which they're guaranteed by the United States Constitution, has grown to over 3,000 people in Little Lafayette Parish waiting because we don't have enough money to pay for their defense teams.
Mm. Pearson, earlier you talked a little bit about Southern politics generally. Do you have some thoughts about why Donald Trump has done so well in the South?
Well, there's a strong streak of cantankerous individualism that runs through Southern politics. And we've seen that, you know, the idea of the person who kind of thumbs his nose at institutions. And, you know, it's an odd mix because we also talk about the South as maybe the most devout part of the country. And it kind of is, but it also has that wild element. And it's the South where patriotism is the most robust. And the idea that, you know, we're going to get our own bully, Donald Trump, to stand up and poke the bad guy in the eye with his thumb appeals kind of to the gut instincts of the less informed voters.
What's going on with the hardcore Southern evangelicals and fundamentalists that in this election, they turned to Donald Trump, though Donald Trump is probably the least religious person running this time?
My answer to that question is that it's a demographic blip. There are some people who say they have deep religious convictions that support Donald Trump. But I think in the Republican Party, those people are unhappy right now, or they're with Ted Cruz. I mean, there's no way that a deeply religious person can support Donald Trump on the basis of religion. It's clear he knows nothing about the Bible. He says he owns one. I'm not so sure. I suppose I should take him at his word. But it's just hard to imagine how that could happen. So I'm choosing to believe that it isn't that people of faith have really got on their knees and said, yes, God's told me Donald is the one. Mm-hmm. I'm choosing to believe that those are people to whom religion is not so important.
Well, and just because we're friends, I'll share this with you. But I think you're exactly right. And I actually think there is some health to a transition from saying we're going to give all of our religion to one political party. They've done that. They've lost and they've lost and they've lost. And now they just want to win. And they're going to stay whatever they are in their churches, but they want to win this election.
We've seen all across the world that any time religion gets involved in politics, like where you have the religious party and the non-religious party, that's a bad thing. Frankly, people in both parties are religious or not religious.
Right.
And that's the way it should be. I mean, one of the reasons that America has done so well is we have these cross-cutting cleavages that don't allow us to spill over into genocidal conflict. And if we start to all line up, all the people who care about religion in one party, all the people who don't in the other, all the whites in one party, all the blacks in the other, those kind of cleavages are very dangerous for us as a democracy.
Let's go to the other party, the other candidates there. Why was Clinton so attractive to Southerners rather than Bernie Sanders?
I don't think that Southerners specifically are prejudiced against Jews. I wouldn't want to go there. But I would say that being a Jew from the Northeast is not going to endear yourself to Southerners. Clinton does have some Arkansas roots. Clinton is clearly super popular with African-American voters. African-American voters, of course, make up over 50% of the Democratic Party in most Southern states. So that being so, and because of Bill Clinton's historic popularity among African-American voters, that gives Hillary Clinton an enormous leg up in Southern states.
What are you saying to your students about what they can learn from this particular election cycle?
You never say never. I mean, this is one of those cycles that is proving all other cycles wrong. We're headed perhaps, and it's looking more and more like that, we're headed to a contested convention on the Republican side. Of course, they did it to themselves a little bit with the Republican Party did with creating rules that allowed this to happen that didn't build to a majority. Mm-hmm. But this is groundbreaking in the modern era, in the modern Twitter, tweeting, social media age, to go to a contested convention. Nobody's been into this territory. So for those people who say that American politics is predictable, boy, this is, and with Donald Trump, this is the season of unpredictability.
Hmm. Take a moment and critique both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party in terms of what you see as serious mistakes they've made in this election cycle. And if there's something that you want to affirm, do that as well.
The Republican Party and the Democratic Party have a very similar problem, and that is that many of the mainstream elements in their party are not attracted to those people who would putatively be their most representative candidates. So in the Republican Party, for example, we saw a number of the governors, you know, the Rick Perrys, the Scott Walkers, the Chris Christies, the people who had been around for a long time that were clearly very experienced, ready to step in and be president. Those people were rejected on the basis of being too establishment. Now, kind of the same thing is happening over on the Democratic side, and that is that there's been a revolt against Hillary Clinton for being the next person up, the too establishment candidate, and a lot of people are rallying to say, no, not this. So both parties have made mistakes by not cultivating the kind of mainstream appeal to their voters and to a slice of the electorate that can be well represented by a particular candidate. As a result, they both have these retrograde revolutions on their hand, the Trump revolution on the Republican side and the Bernie Sanders revolution on the Democratic side.
Are there policies that are really important in the South that need to be discussed but are not being discussed?
One of the huge things that's not getting the discussion I think it needs, and that is that we are a country in which inequality is increasing. And in the South, with an already historically poor and downtrodden underclass, both white and black, the gap between those who have and those who do not have is getting bigger and more insurmountable. The idea that somehow you can lever yourself out. Every study says we are, in fact, becoming more and more the two Americas, the Americas of the haves and the Americas of the have-nots. Mm-hmm. And it's getting harder and harder to cross that line. And I worry that in the South, particularly, that this conversation is not one that we're having with any kind of seriousness.
One question has just bugged me ever since I've been in Louisiana.
Why do people eat crawfish?
that's good. That's one. Another is, why do we vote against our own interests?
Well, you know, the people who always say that are not the people who are actually doing the voting. There are people who are pointing out the objective interest, you know, and it doesn't speak to the identity of people. You know, when people vote for, if you're a poor person and you vote for someone who's advocating not raising the minimum wage, not expanding earned income tax credit, not expanding housing credits or vouchers or anything like that, you are objectively voting against your interests. But hey, that may be the candidate that you identify with as what you want to be like, either ideologically, religiously, socially, or some other factor. So the factors that are most important to the individual aren't those kind of objective factors that social scientists or you and I would look around and say, hey, why are you doing that?
Mm-hmm. How's this election going to play out?
Wow. Well, if I had to say right now, I think it's going to be a contested convention. I don't think Trump's going to win. I think the most likely candidate's going to be Cruz. Kasich second, dark horse, Paul Ryan, whoever, third. So at this point, I'm starting to think that if Trump doesn't walk in with a majority, and he needs to get, I think, 57% of the remaining delegates in order to go to the convention with a majority, I don't think he's going to get there. If he doesn't have it, I don't think he's going to be the nominee.
And what about on the other side?
On the other side, I think it's going to be Hillary. The real question is, who does she pick for her vice presidential running mate? Clearly, Bernie has pushed her to the left. But Hillary's not going to have much problem tacking back to the center because at heart, she is still an Arkansas kind of Democrat. She's not exactly a Southern Democrat, but she's not as progressive as, say, a Bernie or Elizabeth Warren. So ultimately, I think the Democrats are looking great. If you look down the road, you say all this is not good for the Republican Party. You know, what's really good is that assured march to victory by candidate that everybody agrees on. The party gets united behind the candidate. The money comes in and they run to election. All this dissension, that's not good for getting people elected.
So who comes out as the new president?
Hillary's the new president.
Dr. Pearson Cross is associate professor of political science at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, where he also serves as the associate dean of the College of Liberal Arts. I really do thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
We first met activist Zach Copland while he was still in high school. It's been inspiring to follow his work during the intervening years, because his passion hasn't faded and his effectiveness has only grown. Zach's been on this show many, many times, and this is the first time I've ever seen his face, and so we now know what each other look like as well as what we sound like. Zach, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me on. It's a blast to actually meet you in person.
The last time you were on, you told some really hair-raising stories about public school students exposed to blatant religious pressures about proselytizing. I could just assume those situations are now completely resolved, but I think I know Louisiana better than that, so give us an update.
So those situations are actually ongoing, and the reality is there's no one who's really gone to court against these schools. I think the most egregious thing that we talked about on creationism was I got a hold of an email from a science teacher at Airline High in Bossier, Louisiana, who explained that she was going to bring the book of Genesis into class, and then they're going to read the book of Genesis in science class and then debunk evolution with other supplemental materials that show how wrong evolution is. And I talked to kids from Bossier who, of course, they're all very afraid to have their names out there because the environment was just so unwelcoming to people who didn't except that the earth was 6,000 years old, for example. And they were talking about how, oh yeah, my teacher showed us creationist videos and we read Bible verses in health class and we didn't really learn anything. We were forced to go to the Fellowship of Christian Athletes meetings during class. And so all of this is still going on because there's no one who has challenged these teachings in court.
And that has to mean that the school administrators know what's going on, and they're either turning their head the other way or they're supporting it.
Oh, they're proudly supporting it. And the principal, Mr. Jason Rowland, first was on that email I talked about. The email was to him so he could come into class and watch creationism being taught. And he apparently would do things like shout prayers over the intercom, especially after a terrorist attack. He would go and we'd get really worked up after a terrorist attack and shout a prayer into the intercom. And so the ACLU criticized him and sent a letter saying you have to stop doing this. And the entire community, about 1,000, 1,200 people maybe, sort of my estimate, turned out. And I showed up and watched this and had a prayer rally and prayed for the principal and brought him out there with – we had Senator David Vitter show up. All the local politicians showed up to stand by the teaching of religion in schools. Mm. And so we really need a court case to stop this stuff. That's what's going to have to happen. There's going to have to be a brave kid and a brave family in Bossier, Louisiana, or in Ouachita, or in some other part of the state, because if you bring it to court, what's happening in one part of the state can address what's happening in another part too. So we need a brave kid who's been taught creationism to say, this is wrong, this is what happened to me, and I'm not going to take it, I'm going to go to court.
Zach, is anybody on the horizon to really take this on like it needs to be taken on? Or are there people out there working on that?
It's really going to have to take us by surprise, I think, because it's going to be someone neither you or me know probably if it ever gets taken on. And we'll find out about him pretty quickly, I think. But it's going to have to be probably a 14, 15, 16-year-old kid
mm-hmm.
who hates what's happening to him, whose parents don't like what's happening either, and just say, as a family, this is wrong, and we're going to be brave. Because it really, you have to be brave. Mm-hmm. You have to be incredibly brave. And so that's what it's going to take, is someone we probably have never met who just finds that spark of courage inside mm-hmm. themselves and says, we're going to do this.
Since you left Rice, what's been your other focuses?
So I think I can finally sort of join the Investigative Journalist Club. And I've just been going story by story right now. I finished up a story on human trafficking for the Daily Beast that should be out. The story is Why You Shouldn't Lie to a Reporter, where it turns out all the numbers on trafficking. There's these numbers that have been put out by anti-trafficking organizations that are like 300,000 kids are being trafficked in America, and it sounds horrifying. This is not to discount how awful human trafficking is, but there's not 300,000 kids trafficked. That actually came from a study that said 200,000, 300,000 kids were at higher risk, which is dramatically different. Mm-hmm. So it helps no one to oversell the amount. So we're finding remedies for 200,000 kids that don't exist instead of helping the ones who are actually kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of, I was doing a story and I was like, everyone's lying to me. I really don't like this. And so the story turned into, here's how the numbers are wrong. We have to start with good numbers before we can solve these problems. So that's mm-hmm. one story. And we talked about another story that I can't spoil here.
Okay.
About sex abuse in churches. I've got my own little take on that. And I think it's going to cause some shockwaves.
You've mentioned the Second Giant Leap for Humankind mm-hmm. project several times on this show, but we've never had the time really to let you describe that project fully. So I'd like you to do that now.
So this is just sort of a long-term goal. And honestly, I'm going to say it's depressing. I've not pushed too hard on these kind of things just because our Congress right now is in such a gridlock and so unwilling to do anything that we just can't get anywhere. But the goal is to invest an obscene amount of money in science funding. So I was saying $1 trillion. I will take any amount of money we're investing in science funding as a start. And honestly, $1 trillion, that sounds like a lot of money. But when we talk about the U.S. government budget, $1 trillion over 10 years is actually a pretty small amount mm-hmm. of the budget that we spend compared to something like our military. And the difference is science is an investment. It does stuff for us in terms of our health and welfare, and it actually makes money for people and the government. And so mm-hmm. The way to think about it is like if you start a company, you take out a loan, and you go into debt to start your company because you expect it to make you money in the long term. And with science, the government might as well spend some money on basic research because in the long term, someone's going to invent Google, someone's going to invent the internet, someone's going to invent mm-hmm. a car or whatever the equivalent that I can't predict in the future. And people are going to sell it, and that's going to make money for them, and the government's going to tax it, and that's money for the government. It's all a way better investment. So if Congress would ever get their act together and say, this is something smart, mm-hmm. we need to invest in science, that would be that's what I want to see, and that's what I'm pushing for.
Can you get that kind of support outside of Congress? In other words, can you get that kind of support for people who will press Congress to do that?
I would hope, but the problem you see, there's a couple sort of issues that we always struggle with. And the first is that science is not a life and death issue immediately. So if you're talking about something that's really hot right now, police brutality, if you're worried that I'm going to walk down the street and someone's going to racially profile you and say, I'm going to pull you over and I can end up dead. That's something it's an existential panic. You have to worry about that. You have to care about that. And there's nothing more important than being out protesting that because it's your life. Science, well, maybe I get cancer and I'm not going to get that cancer cured because we don't have the technology. We haven't done that research. But that's not I need to be out there now fighting for it because the stress level that it's going to cause you is not there. So you're not going to miss work. You're not going to put your kids with a babysitter. You're not going to do all the things that it takes to get out there and fight for it.
If our listeners are interested in that and want to know more about it or get involved in it, how would they do that?
I mean, the biggest thing is call Congress. And there's organizations out there that are very concerned about science funding, mm-hmm. general science organizations, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the Association for biochemistry and molecular biology.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I know, I've done a lobbying day with them where I went to Congress and said, pay for science. And there's these organizations that set up, you can go talk to them, they can bring you to D.C., they can have you meet with people, they can tell you who to call. And they're great groups to get in contact with mm-hmm. and say, we want to help fight for science funding, because they're always looking for more people.
Zach, I've always described you as an example of someone who saw a need and stepped up to try to fill it. As I said, going back to your high school work opposing creationist teachings in public school classrooms, today I want to ask you a different kind of question. What lessons have you learned from your mistakes? What insights can you share with others who are ready to try to affect change but would benefit from some of what you've learned along the way?
So for me personally, it's just, I'm not sure how helpful this is to a lot of listeners, but I'm super disorganized and I wish I was more organized. When it comes down to it, I guess we have a law in Louisiana we've talked about many times, the creationism law. We've tried to repeal it. We have never succeeded. Partially that's because we're up against a gigantic mountain. We're fighting against people like Senator Mike Walsworth, who, until we can show him an E. coli turning into a person in front of his eyes, he's going to support creationism. And that's the reality we're up against. But on the other hand, we had a problem where we didn't have evidence when we first got involved in this, that we knew the law was meant for creationism. Governor Jindal said it was meant for creationism. Senator Ben Nevers said the law was meant for creationism. He said it was to have creation taught wherever Darwin's theory was taught, to have the scientific evidence for both sides. So we knew what it was for. We had school boards saying, one of the board members was like, why can't we use this law? We don't want a lawsuit, but someone has to stand up for Jesus. And they said they were going to use the law to teach creationism. But we never had a teacher teaching creationism. And so we got up there, and the chairman of the committee, the education committee at the time, was this guy, Senator Conrad Appel. And it's not necessarily fair to ask us what he was asking us. Like, I mean, I wasn't a journalist. I wasn't an investigator. I didn't know any of these things at the time. And he said, I will vote for you if you can bring me one thing, which you don't have. You don't have proof of how it's being used. No one is teaching creationism in Louisiana, so I won't vote for you. And he said, all you need to do is bring us proof. And the mistake is, honestly, we didn't have it, and we never had it. And we didn't find it because it's sort of sweating the small stuff and doing what was really hard. And this was a nightmare. I was chasing leads after that committee for 2 years, saying, what is the little piece of the puzzle I can get to pull this out? But we didn't have that information, and we came in unprepared, and we lost. And so for the next 2 years, I spent as much time as I could fighting with school districts who wouldn't give me their records, who were lying to me, who weren't telling me what they were teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get little pieces. I get an email here, an email there. And I had to sue the Louisiana Department of Education for emails. And I eventually got a few emails there that show the department is aware of creationism being taught. And finally built this whole connection between what was happening in Bossier, what was happening in Ouachita, what was happening in Livingston, what's happening with the state, that shows that creationism is being taught. And so that was what we needed to come in with at first. In a way, it is filling the need. I wasn't a reporter. That was a reporter's job.
Yeah.
And I was furious at times where I was like, I'd see these little things, like there was a letter from Ouachita teachers out there in the ether that I didn't have, that was a list of 20 teachers who essentially acknowledged teaching creationism. And there were reporters in the state who knew about it, education reporters, and didn't pursue it.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, why aren't they pursuing it? And finally, I just went and spent 6 months where Ouachita Parish lied to me. They said, that letter doesn't exist, but if it does exist, it's not a public record. And they wouldn't give it to me, and they wouldn't give it to me, and I was fighting with them. And finally, someone messed up, and I just did an email request for something. And on one of the emails they gave me was that letter. And I got it. And I was like, here. And I immediately sent them an email. I was like, you lied to me. If you ever do this again, I'm suing you. I've got evidence. You claimed you didn't know what this was. It wasn't in your files. It didn't exist. And here's your school board members talking about this letter.
Yeah.
And then when it came down to it, Senator Pell, we brought in this information and he voted against us anyway.
Mm.
But that was, I mean, you come in there, you've got to have everything. And we took 2 years of hits.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing, we can go give him what he wants. And he can do the wrong thing and he can break his word. And that's on him. But we should have had it at first.
Yeah, that's a good, very good point. Well, one last question for today. You have come back from Rice to a state in which you really have laid it on the line and trying to make significant change. You've been rebuffed in a lot of places. You've lost some struggles that you had every right to win. Why'd you come back?
My family's here. I grew up here. And so, honestly, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to share this story. But, so when I was 17, I got an invitation once to go to a class that James Carville taught at Tulane. And I don't know if you're allowed to also curse on the show, but to quote James, I was invited to one class, and he was like, he asked his aide, he's like, well, who's this little shit who keeps asking questions? He's smart. Mm-hmm. And so he told me, he's like, you're welcome back whenever you want. Mm. And I took him up on the offer, and I came back every single class after that. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten to know him over the last few years. And so he told me, he's like, I mean, first he was furious at me for leaving the state in the first place. And he made me promise that I was going to come back and fight for the state. And it is something you have to care about. Like that you, I mean, this is home, and there's nowhere else in the country that this is as much of a battle on display. I mean, it's not just Louisiana. New York, there's teachers teaching creationism. Wyoming, there's teachers teaching creationism. California, and I've seen schools in all those places where there's reports of creationism. But Louisiana is the only place where you have someone like our new senator, Senator Milkovich, who just recently announced that that heliocentric rock circles prove creationism. I don't know what heliocentric rock circles are, but he said they prove creation, and that's why he was supporting creationism in our classrooms. And so it's the only place in the country besides Texas. And maybe, well, Alabama sometimes and Florida sometimes, but it's where the battle is. Yeah.
Zach Copland is a dynamic young leader and activist with a focus on promoting science education and protecting classrooms from the inappropriate inclusion of religious dogma into secular curricula. Zach, I'm glad you came back, and I'm glad you were at the Freedom for All Faiths forums, and I want to thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person. Have them tune in as well. Ask them to join the conversation. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that's grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.